drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. Technology is bringing amazing new advances in prosthetics. Hands with fine motor control, arms and legs that allow our Paralympians to break records. Brain implants are even replicating the sensation of touch. But across the world, there are more than 30 million people in need of prosthetics, and many of them live in developing countries without enough doctors, let alone the latest technology. But a different sort of technology might be the answer. My guests today have been working to create a more affordable future in prosthetics. Professor Peter Lee is a professor of biomedical engineering at the University of Melbourne. Louise Pulai is an international lecturer at Human Study EV. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So just a very basic question to start off. When we're talking about prosthetics, what does that mean? What sort of things do you create?
I think prosthetics is really a replacement of a missing part of the body. So whether it's limbs, facial prosthetics, upper limb prosthetics, lower limb prosthetics.
So any part of the body that's missing.
Yep.
What sort of things do you create?
Yeah, so I think prosthetics has moved from just being a cosmetic component to a more functional component. So I think the main function is probably the key. So the whole idea is to not just replicate a missing body part, but also replicate the function, the missing function due to the missing body parts.
So that's the key thing, isn't it? That it's not just about aesthetics. It has to be presumably and ultimately fully functional.
Yes.
Yeah, but also you've got to consider that the prosthesis and its function is uniquely in tune to what the patient wants it to be. So a perfect prosthesis might be a plastic arm with a bucket so they can shower independently, or it could be something so technological that has electrodes that they can move with their mind, but both equally functional and may meet the patient's needs.
So what is the most complicated part of a prosthetic?
Take, for example, the lower limb. You've got a foot, the anchor, you've got a pylon that represents sort of the shank, they call it. And then the adapters, if you have an amputation below the knee joint, you then have that socket that fits onto the residual limb. But if you lose the knee joint, you would then need an artificial knee. Right? If you look at the entire prosthesis, there are many components that you probably could say off the shelf, except for one, which is the one that interfaces the human to the rest of the artificial limb.
So the hardest part is the bit effectively that joins to
Absolutely.
The body.
Absolutely. The interface between, or the relationship between that socket that connects to the prosthesis to the human body is by far the most important, and a poorly fitting socket can mean that the whole rest of it, which may seem like a Meccano set that fits together, won't function at all if it doesn't fit nicely, comfortably, and uniquely to each individual patient.
Why is that so hard? Is it a question of comfort?
It's definitely a question of comfort, and it's also a question of suspension. So we often fit a prosthesis to a round part of the body. You can imagine someone that loses their limb above the knee, it's round, your thigh is a round shape. So if you can imagine putting a bucket on a round shape and trying to hang on, it will just spin, it can fall off. We need to have a unique, I guess, force system. We use biomechanics to apply forces to the limb to stop it from being so round so that we can hold on and the leg doesn't fall off while the patient's ambulating.
And where are we at in terms of the technology to make that work? Because if you look at kind of the development of prosthetics over the last couple of years, it seems like a revolution has gone on. Are we there yet in terms of the perfect fit?
We're very far from what we hope to achieve. If you look at the whole artificial limbs, especially in the lower limb, I think many of us have seen the Paralympians competing with very fancy components, you know, carbon fiber foot, energy storage release components, some of which we are even thinking that could outperform a normal, you know, healthy limb. But when you come to the socket, we're still really working with very old artisan ideas. So socket biomechanics really started somewhere after the Second World War. And at that time, engineers got involved and tried to create a fit that is based on, you know, skeletal components and how load is being transferred from the ground to the body. But that hasn't changed much since the 50s. What has maybe improve the condition is new materials like silicon liners, some flexible sockets. But the shape, the ideas around the socket is still very much based on what's been proposed in the 50s.
Do you think we need a revolution then on how that part of it works?
On how the patient interface works, yeah, definitely. And I think there's lots and lots of research being done all around the world looking into those exact topics, but we're definitely not quite there yet, but there has been improvements and we're looking forward to the future, really.
How expensive is an average prosthetic? Take a lower limb, as we've been talking about, maybe not Olympics level, but just an everyday leg. How expensive is that for somebody who's in that situation?
It's really virtually impossible to say because, as we talked about, all the different parts of a limb, from the foot to the adapters to the pylon to the different materials, it's actually impossible. Every prosthesis is so customised that there's no two that are the same or two that cost the same. Yeah, depending on the patient's
requirements. What's the range, though? I mean, from
10 to 150,000 or more, depending on the components used.
And you've both been involved with developing countries to help create more affordable prosthetics. How are you aiming to do that? How can you do that to change the economics here?
Our interest has primarily been the socket. I think the difficulties that developing countries face are really not so much the components, because the components, like Luis was saying, you got $10,000 components, you got $100,000 components, you even got $100 components. So your components can be as simple as a rubber foot, polypropylene type plastics. The International Committee of the Red Cross has contributed to that space quite a bit. They have design very low-cost components. I think what difficulties that developing country faces is the expertise to build the sockets.
Absolutely agree with you there. I think it's one thing to be able to provide something low-cost or even for free, but if there's no professional in that country or no access to a pathway to education to become a prosthetist or orthotist in that country, which we know is true for 80% of countries of the world have no training programs for the profession of prosthetist orthotist. So we can provide all the low-cost components we want, but if there's nobody there who can assess the patient to fit the device, to follow up and then to provide another one in the future, we're already on the back foot, I think, there.
So in that sense, it's about building the workforce.
We must build capacity, and I think it's not enough to send 10 skilled Australian prosthetists to, to some country anywhere in the world for a number of weeks, because it's not a sustainable solution. And if we keep doing that, we're never going to get countries to invest in training professionals in their own country. And I guess that's sort of part of where my work comes in with human studies. So we created a virtual classroom. We realised that you couldn't possibly build a bricks and mortar school in every single developing country. We didn't have the funds, and honestly, we can be more innovative than that these days. We look at innovation in the components. We need to look at innovation in education. And so it has to be this way. Human Study are the only group in the world doing this type of education. And so what we do is we bring our students together in a virtual classroom. I've got students in Syria, Afghanistan, Gaza, in 15 different countries, actually, more than 150 students at the moment enrolled. And we just bring them together once a semester, actually, in a safe area in their region, whether it be Turkey, Egypt, or another country, to do the hands-on with the patients, making that. But then we send them back to their own countries to continue to work and study whilst they're in their environments helping their communities.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvalis. You're in the drawing room, and I'm joined tonight by Louise Pular. She's an international lecturer at Human Study EV, and Professor Peter Lee, who's a professor of biomedical engineering at the University of Melbourne. That's a really fascinating idea. What is the vision? How many professionals are you hoping to train through this kind of model?
Well, it's so interesting you ask that, because even in Australia, we don't meet world standards for the number of professionals per head of population. We don't know. So, for example, I also, in another role, work as a professional standards officer for the Australian Orthotic Prosthetic Association. And our workforce data shows that, for example, in Victoria, we have one prosthetist orthotist per about 30,000 people. If you look at Western Australia, for example, it's about one per 175,000 people. So we don't have equal dispersion even in our own country. And I think it's all related to the access to education. So for 30 years, we've had one institution in the whole country, in fact, the whole Southern Hemisphere, providing this education at La Trobe Uni in Melbourne. Until there's more access to education outside of these central regions, we won't have great dispersion of the workforce.
Peter, does that concern you, the the training, the building of the workforce, the kind of coverage, even in Australia, let alone the rest of the world?
Yeah, that's something that we recognize very early. As an engineer, you know, we sort of very solution focused. So one of the challenges is to look at this problem and see whether technology can play a part. So over the past years, we've been developing techniques that hopefully reduces the amount of skills needed to build a prosthetic sockets. And that technique is how we try to pitch, you know, whether we could solve this lack of prosthetists and orthotists problem in developing countries.
$10,000 at the lower end is still such a lot of money.
Yeah, that's, I guess, more about an Australian environment. The ICRC, the Red Cross components, we've been talking about are significantly less expensive than that, but also they're 100% made of plastics. So the beautiful thing about that is they can be produced locally and in a sustainable way that a country can maintain that service. From making the components to providing the service all in their own space rather than having to, you know, order components from Germany like we commonly do here in Australia.
Yeah. This is quite important to note that we are talking about appropriate technology more than technology for the sake of technology. For example, if you have a computer controlled microprocessor type, you know, ankle joint, knee joint, if you give it to somebody that's going to take it to the paddy field and soak it in water, it's just not going to work. So, you know, the $100,000 leg is not going to serve the purpose of, you know, a $50, $100 leg. So I think it's important to understand the demographic, the people that, you know, we are serving or focusing on, you know, and then match those technology to that, those purpose.
Yeah, and I mean, that's not to say in some developing countries there isn't the need for those high-end devices. There absolutely is, but it might not be for everyone. And so I guess the skill of training those professionals would be to work with each individual client to build sort of that rapport and understand what do they actually need and then how can you provide that.
And what are the differences between a top-of-the-line or even a standard prosthetic and one of these 3D printed versions?
So when you talk about the cost of the prosthesis, it's largely due to the components. Because the socket is still based on very much, you know, artisan techniques or technology. And it's going to be a basic plastic component. And it's made quite similarly anywhere else in the world. Of course, some prosthetists will market themselves as, you know, highly skilled, just like sometimes you prefer this doctor versus that doctor, and then they could charge more. But I think, in essence, most of the cost of the prosthesis has come from the components. So when you look at components, then, of course, you have computer-controlled components, and then you have a very passive, you know, just a joint-type component, a mechanical joint. And that itself, you know, has a big difference in price and cost.
Yeah, I agree. It's so interesting that people talk about how you can get a good treatment here in Australia, but you can actually get a good treatment elsewhere as well. I mean, I would trust my students in Syria to make a beautiful, comfortable socket for my mum. It's not because they're less skilled. They might have less access to technology, but that patient interface, like you said, that mastercraft of making a socket and manipulating the shape so that it's effective and comfortable, it's the same across the world. We all do that as prosthetists, orthotists, and that's something that we're uniquely trained to do, I guess, through all of our education. With the 3D printing, we appreciate this is a massive introduction and massive growth in technology space, but I guess it takes so many years and university training to build that craft that I can go to Aldi and buy myself a 3D printer, but it doesn't build the skill I need to deal with the individual patient to build their goals and hopes and dreams of participation in society and to give them exactly what they need, despite the fact that I could probably 3D print it.
So for an Australian individual or family who can't afford the $10,000 version, can we get the cheaper version?
Free. So in Australia, we have a wonderful public health system that supports our amputees in society. So if you're either born without a limb or if you acquire a limb loss in your life, you can receive a prosthesis funded. The National Disability Insurance Scheme has just come in for everybody under 65. And everyone in Australia is entitled to access that service, and they get a free prosthetic limb that hopefully suits their needs.
That's really interesting because technology is also changing rapidly. Mm-hmm. So within the, now I'm getting in the weeds, but I'm so fascinated by this, okay? what kind of updates or versions can people get? Because I imagine, you know, within a couple of years, a new prosthetic is available, which is, you know, vastly potentially better. Yep. Does the system allow for that?
Yeah, I think it does, because technology is just like your phone. It's getting cheaper and cheaper. And I think similarly with prosthetic components, they will get cheaper as time goes on. However, I think the real challenge is still the sockets, because, you know, we talk about, you know, a $100,000 limb. If you put on somebody that just cannot wear that socket, they would just have to ditch the whole prosthesis. So that on the socket side, there are of course innovations that we are all trying to pitch, whether, you know, it's a smart socket, a socket that changes shape. I think that will be the future. This is actually quite an interesting topic around the socket, because I think there's not a lot of effort or R&D that's gone in. I think engineers has stayed away from it because over the years it's been recognized as a form of art.
Yeah, you know, it's not an exact science, is it? You can't give any two people the same measurement or the same profile.
And that's because all of our limbs are different.
That's exactly
right.
You're not going to find two identical people that have the same needs.
Yeah. However, I've sort of over the years we've been working on that and the research that we are doing. So what we did is what we call a pressure cast technique. We have literally a tank that's filled with water, and between the water and, you know, it's a sort of a plastic diaphragm, and then we ask amputee to put their residual limb into the tank, and we just crank up the water pressure and compresses the limb. And I think the compression creates a socket, a shape, which we then duplicate that as the socket. So we are pretty aggressive with our trial in Vietnam. What we did that time is we say we have a very good process working with us, but we come to an agreement that says that let's don't do any rectification. Just use the exact shape and fit it onto the patient and see if it works. And if it doesn't work, let's find out why. If it works, let's find out why as well. And we trialed 53 subjects in Vietnam, and we managed to get 31 of them fitted comfortably. So that was a big surprise.
And that's a pretty high rate, isn't it?
Yes, that's like a 70% success. And even then, if you ask a prosthetist or say, you know, in a clinic setting, the chances of failure is as high as, you know, 20-30%, even for a handmade socket. So there's something there that we are seeing that got us all excited. Should we, you know, then look at the pressure casting as one of the techniques that could solve this lack of skill, lack of people type problem? So I have to be very clear, we are not trying to replace prosthetists here, because I think that skills that's been, you know, accumulated over the years is so important. But what we think is that there's a group of patients that probably could be fitted with the PCAS, and that leaves the other 30% that, you know, very often we may say that you can't wear a socket, and that's where we find that the prosthetist could, you know, really get into advancing their skills to
into this group.
Yeah, the complicated group, and say, how do you then, you know, be able to fit the socket? And I think that's where the art really comes into play.
Yeah, and I mean, if we look at what's currently happening, building schools, training people in traditional methods, we will never meet the need in this generation. People will not get what they need, both in Australia and abroad. So I really applaud efforts to find more reproducible ways to produce more limbs, because we know the need is there. We know the skills aren't there. There's no expertise, the lack of education. There's so many challenges. So the profession absolutely is so excited to partner with individuals such as yourself to search for these solutions so that we can, you know, duplicate our efforts on a greater scale and treat more people.
Before I let you go, you are both so passionate about this. I'd love to know what's motivated you to go into this field. What is it about prosthetics and helping people in this area? I mean, where did you first become interested in prosthetics?
I'm sort of fascinated by the human body. There's just so much to learn. And of course, when you see someone with a challenge, like a missing limb, and you always ask yourself, oh, you know, can you restore that function? You know, when you start getting into it, then you realize restoring function is not so much a biomechanical challenge. I think it has a whole big area of getting a person back into the workforce, getting a person socially accepted, you know. And one of the things that really fascinated me over the years working in prosthetics is if you look at, say, maybe even 15 years ago, you don't see amputees walking around showing off their prosthesis. Right. They like to cover it because they feel that, you know, if I don't tell people that, you know, I have an artificial limb, people will accept me better. But I think technology has improved so much that it really restored the function of the person. So if you see an amputee walk, if the amputee now hide the artificial limb, you can't tell whether he's or she is an amputee. So I think that raises the confidence of the individual, so much so that, you know, one could be proud that, hey, you know, I may not have a limb, but I'm doing just as well as you and I.
So it's transforming people's
lives. Yes. I think that technology has really transformed not just restoring function, but even the perception. Right. I mean, seeing somebody in the Paralympics or even in the Olympics competing with able body who is an amputee, that is quite fascinating.
How about for you, Louise?
I really agree. And as a traveller at heart, I mean, travelling around the world and you see amputees not able to participate. And I mean, that's not why I got into this profession. I guess from the beginning I got into it because I felt like it was so interesting. We study prosthetics and orthotics as a dual discipline qualification. And so we come out with skills to treat the whole body from head to toe, different types of patients. We come out with the hand skills as well as our clinical skills. And for me, that was just fascinating to learn everything. I was always eager to turn up to university every day to learn about this. There was always something new and every patient's different. Every patient's a new challenge and you get to be your own, I guess, innovator for every client and work together with them to make an option that that meets their needs to, as you said so correctly, to participate. I mean, studies show that participation in things that you love is highly linked to your body image and self-worth. So if you can do the things you love, you can love yourself, whether it's with a prosthetic leg or with your two legs that you've got, it doesn't matter. So long as you're able to sort of live your dreams, you can feel fulfilled in life.
Thank you to both of you for coming in. It's been such a good conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And joining me tonight in the drawing room, Professor Peter Lee, a professor of biomedical engineering at the University of Melbourne, and Louise Pulai is an international lecturer at Human Study EV. And you can catch Professor Lee at the Designing the Body Forum as part of Melbourne Design Week.